I'm Marty Moscowen. Welcome to Radio Times. Pennsylvania, like other states, is dealing with an increase in vaping-related illnesses, even death. Last week, Philadelphia Mayor Jim Kenney and Health Commissioner Dr. Thomas Farley proposed legislation to ban the sale of flavored e-cigarettes and vape pods to minors. While vaping has been promoted to adults as a way to reduce or quit smoking, there's concern that vaping is becoming more popular among teenagers. The CDC says that e-cigarettes do contain nicotine and are unsafe for kids, teens, and young adults. Well, we asked Dr. Farley to join us on Radio Times to tell us what Philadelphia is going to do to prevent teens from getting their hands on vaping products. And Dr. Farley, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Good morning.
How big a problem is teen vaping in Philadelphia? Do we know?
Well, we know that 10% of high school seniors vape. Nationally, though, it's more than 25% of high school seniors are vaping. And we don't want Philadelphia to go the way the rest of the country has gone. We want to protect our teens from this unknown risk.
Why focus on flavored e-cigarettes or flavored pods?
Well, first of all, we're seeing two big problems across the country. We're seeing this epidemic of very serious lung disease caused by e-cigarettes with more than 1,400 deaths. Most of the vape products contain THC, but there's no one product clearly the cause. And then we're also seeing this stunning surge in e-cigarette use among teenagers. As I said, now 25% of high school students doing this. That's more than doubled in the past 2 years. Now, those teenagers are attracted to e-cigarettes by a few of the features for Juul, which is what has really caused the surge. Part of it is the designs were, because there's no plume, people don't see it, so it's easier for teens to hide. But also partly, there's the flavor. There's candy flavors like mango that attract teenagers. We know that the vast majority of teenagers use the flavors and that they say that the flavors are what helped get them started.
You mentioned Juul. Is Juul, do you think, targeting teenagers with their flavored products?
Juul absolutely is targeted teenagers when they started out, and they advertise on social media. Teens then have amplified that advertising themselves. And Juul is dangerous in many ways. The other feature of it, which you didn't mention, is it has extraordinarily high levels of nicotine. They use a form of nicotine called nicotine salts, which enables them to have about three times as much nicotine as the previous e-cigarette products. And that makes them much more addictive. And so the legislation that we proposed here would restrict the sale of flavored products, but also restrict the sale of high nicotine salt-containing products. I wouldn't say that they couldn't sell them, but they could only sell them in stores that teens are not allowed in.
Well, let me pick up on that, because this is aimed at, I guess, specific stores or retailers, things like gas stations or convenience stores. So if they are selling these products like flavored e-cigarettes, how would a store monitor or even police the sale of these products?
Well, under the bill, there would be two types of stores that would sell e-cigarettes. There would be one that have a regular tobacco sales permit. That might be your typical convenience store. And they could still sell e-cigarettes, but they could only sell them the ones that were unflavored or had the lower nicotine amounts. And they already are not supposed to sell to teens.
Right.
And we regulate them by having teens go in and test buying them and citing them if they sell products to teens. Then there would be stores that are not allowed to have teens in them at all. They have to establish a policy, no children allowed in the store, and they could sell the flavored or the higher nicotine products, and we will also inspect and monitor those.
Are those the so-called vape stores where teenagers are not allowed?
Well, right now, those vape stores may have a voluntary policy where no children are allowed, but in this case, they'd have to explicitly say to the health department that they're not allowing any minors in the store, and we think that the types of stores who do this typically would be the vape shops.
I'm curious about the stores that do sell these vape products. Are you saying that in Philadelphia they won't be able to sell flavored vape products?
Again, the stores that choose to not allow children in them could sell the flavored products or the high nicotine products. But the other tobacco retailers in the city, and there's some 2,600 other tobacco retailers in the city, they could continue to sell these cigarettes, but they could not sell the flavored products or the high nicotine products, and they couldn't sell any products to children.
So we're talking about, just to name some names, like Wawa, 7-Eleven, stores like that?
Wawa and 7-Eleven, I imagine, would not choose to be an adult-only store because they want to be able to serve children with other products. And so they would sell the lower nicotine, unflavored versions of e-cigarettes.
Is this proposed legislation modeled on another city or another state that's trying to do the same thing?
You know, cities and states across the country have tried various ways to address the problem. Some of them are banning flavors outright. Some of them are proposing to ban e-cigarettes outright. We chose an approach here that we think is an appropriate balance. It still allows adults to access the products that have the higher nicotine that may be more dangerous, but it doesn't allow them to be marketed heavily in neighborhoods across the city. So we think that's the approach balance given the risks and maybe some potential value of some of these products for adult smokers who want to quit.
So if I wanted to buy a flavored e-cigarette in Philadelphia, where would I get that?
You would have to go to a store that has a policy that no children are allowed, and they've notify that of the health department. So far, this is a new proposal. It hasn't been put in place yet.
Right.
When they are, you have to go to one of those stores.
You mentioned the lung diseases, something like, what did you say, something like 1,400 deaths in the country based on someone using these vape lease pods?
So there's more than 1,400 cases, not 1,400 deaths. More than two dozen people have died, however. And most of those people have vaped THC, which is the active ingredient in marijuana, but not everyone. And it's still really unclear what's causing this problem. So that is very, very worrisome. Even one case of that is something we worry a lot about. And then that's happening with the backdrop of the stunning surge of where a quarter of high school seniors in the country are using e-cigarettes. And I should point out, those high school seniors using e-cigarettes are not smokers trying to quit. These are kids getting newly addicted to an entirely new product, and we really need to be worried about that. No one knows what happens to your lungs after you use a product like Juul for years or even decades, which might happen to these children. And we think the FDA absolutely should regulate these products, but because the FDA hasn't, Philadelphia has to step in.
These lung-related illnesses seem to be associated, though, with THC. Does it make more sense, or at least of the same kind of sense, to go after the black market, for instance, in Philadelphia?
We need to do whatever we can to restrict clamp down on the black market. That's not easy. People are ordering these pods brewed up in somebody's basement in California and having it shipped to them in the mail. So we're also going to have to compare this with education about the idea that these products are unsafe. You shouldn't be using any product unless you're really confident that it's safe. But that's not going to address also the one quarter of high school seniors using e-cigarettes and really addicted to nicotine. Know what happens to them over the long term, and we really need to worry about them.
You talk about sending out a message to young people. There's the Behind the Haze campaign that's going to get started in Philadelphia. How will that work?
So that's messages that we're going to put on social media predominantly, which is where you can find teenagers. That just points out that no one knows what's in these products, but to the extent that we know that there are clearly dangerous chemicals in e-cigarettes, and that the companies that are selling them are not interested in helping people out. They're only interested in getting teens addicted so that they can sell more and make more profit. And so we will hope the teens will have a healthy skepticism about these products with that message.
Well, and teens often feel not only skeptical about everything, but also invincible. How do you get to that?
Well, you know, teens they want to rebel against their parents. They want to rebel against the world in general. And right now, using e-cigarettes feels like an act of rebellion. But we want to point out, you know, there's a big rich company there that wants to get them to do this, that is sort of tapping into that. And we want them to rebel against the companies and not get sucked in by their really misleading marketing of these products.
Have you heard from business organizations and even vaping organizations in response to this proposed legislation?
We have not. We just introduced it last week. We'll find out. It's going to be heard in city council in a couple of weeks, and we'll see what happens.
Do you also see vaping and e-cigarettes as helpful for quitting smoking? And this is something I'll be talking with our other guests about later in the hour. But do you also see the benefits of e-cigarettes?
Well, you know, this is what people will say, or the industry will say, is that these things are helping smokers quit. But we should point out the FDA has approved seven different products for helping smokers quit. They're proven to be safe. They're proven to be effective. E-cigarettes are not in that category. If the companies who make these e-cigarettes want to sell them as a smoking cessation device, they should do the studies to show that they're safe and show that they're effective, get FDA approval as a cessation device, and if they do that, I will be their biggest proponent. I will encourage everyone to use them. Until then, we have to be very skeptical of these products. The FDA doesn't even know what's in these products because it has not required the manufacturers to submit a list of ingredients to them, so no one can say that they're safe. So maybe there's some value to them, but I am really very disturbed that the industry has not taken the step to prove that they're safe and effective and go through the approval process.
Should they be on the market at all?
Well, you know, we haven't chosen to ban them entirely because certainly smoking is a huge public health problem. On the other hand, I would really hope that the industry will take this message to really do the right thing and do those sorts of studies.
I'm glad you raised smoking because it just needs to be said. I had it in my intro, and I'll be talking about this later on in the hour. There's something like 480,000 Americans die every single year as a result of smoking. And while there are concerns about vaping and especially its impact on young people, we have this huge public health problem related to a product that is essentially legal and available.
It indeed, smoking is the number one killer in America, and we need to do everything we can to reduce smoking rates. And the industry, the e-cigarette industry, will present this their product as somehow an alternative to smoking. But again, those 25% of high school kids who are using these products, those are not smokers trying to quit. These are just kids who have been marketed to, and now they've picked up a new nicotine habit. I don't know what's going to happen to their lungs years or decades from now, and I'm very worried about that. So if the e-cigarette industry wants to help smokers quit, I would love to have them do that. There's a path for them to do that. In the meantime, we want to be careful not to get an entirely new set of problems occurring in our teenagers.
Are teenagers smoking in school? I should say vaping in school, in classes?
They absolutely are. The Juul is something you can hide easily in your backpack and your even we've heard about a tie clip. And there's no plume. It's something that's very easy to hide. This is something that high school principals have raised to us, and they're very concerned about it, and they don't know what to do about it.
Have you talked to young people about why they like vaping or want to vape?
I have not talked to them personally, but the studies show that many of them are attracted by the flavors. And then once they get started and they get that feeling of nicotine with the extraordinarily high levels of it, they get a high, and they like that high, and then they get addicted to that high. The product is really designed to be addictive, and that's something we should be worried about.
Where does your legislation go from here, or where does it sit or stand today?
It'll go in front of the Health Committee of the City Council, which will be heard sometime in November. And if we get a favorable vote from the committee, then it goes in front of the full council. And so we hope it'll be passed by the end of the year.
By the end of the year and then go into effect in, 2020?
Yes, like January 1st, I believe.
Well, Dr. Thomas Farley, thank you for joining us today in Radio Times, getting our conversation started.
Thank you.
You're very welcome. And he is the health commissioner for the city of Philadelphia. And last week, he and Philadelphia Mayor Jim Kenney proposed legislation to ban the sale of flavored e-cigarettes and vape pods to minors here in the city of Philadelphia. We're going to take a very short break and then carry on our conversation, talking more about vaping and vape products. And we want to hear from you. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.com. You can also, I should say, tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Much more after this very short break. Do stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Marty Moscoen, and you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Smoking kills an estimated 480,000 Americans every year and is the most preventable death there is. So when vaping was introduced a few years ago as a way to help smokers quit their habit, it felt like a public health breakthrough. Now there's concern that vaping has its own dangers, especially for teens and young adults who have never smoked and are using vape products thinking they are completely safe. Well, we want to talk about the health effects of vaping, the regulations, the advertising, how public health officials view vaping, and how it compares to smoking. And joining us here in our Philadelphia studios is Sean McCormick, Assistant Director of Tobacco Control and Prevention Services at the Health Promotion Council. Sean, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Good morning.
And joining us from Boston is Michael Siegel. He's a physician, professor of community health and sciences at Boston University. And Michael Siegel, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times as well. In fact, I think both of you guests were together a year or so ago. So, Michael, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Well, thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. Sean, you were listening to the health commissioner here in Philadelphia talking about this proposal to keep especially flavored vape products out of the hands of teenagers and young people. I'll just be curious about what you think of what Philadelphia is trying to do.
Yeah, I think I want to thank Dr. Farley for his commitment and efforts pushing forward policy measures like this with tobacco and nicotine control and prevention. It's usually a little bit of treatment, prevention, policy, and everything. So that's great that he's helping push that forward. The flavors have got to be part of the conversation. Dr. Farley's absolutely right. Many, many studies now show that a large proportion, almost 80 to 90% of youth that pick up these devices, pick them up for the flavors or use a flavored product for the first time. So that's a big factor in the initiation, new tobacco product users, new nicotine users through the flavors. The other question with the flavors in particular is that they are unknown in their health effects. And most of the flavors are grass, generally regarded as safe by the FDA.
Grass, not marijuana grass, but grass.
Grass, generally regarded as safe ingredients for something, you know, a cherry flavor in a popsicle would be grass, generally regarded as safe because you're eating that cherry flavoring. It's going through your stomach, through your digestive tract. Your liver and kidneys have a chance to process it. These same flavors are then going, instead of through your digestive tract, straight into your lungs and hitting your lungs right on without any of those other organs having a chance to process those chemicals. So the flavors could be a double punch in terms of the youth.
Michael, let me get you in on the conversation. I know you joined us about quarter after, and what Philadelphia is trying to do, at least coming from the mayor and the health commissioner, is to prevent young people, teenagers, from buying flavored e-cigarettes, flavored pods. And I'd just be curious whether you think that's an effective approach.
Well, I absolutely think that it makes sense to restrict the sale of flavored e-cigarettes, or even all e-cigarettes, to stores that are only that can only sell those products and are only open to adults. But I would add that it doesn't make any sense to me to allow those stores to continue to sell tobacco products that are killing 480,000 people a year. It makes no sense to me to say that, you know, a convenience store or a gas station can't sell a flavored cherry vape, but if they want to sell a deadly Marlboro cigarette, we've got no problem with that. So I think that this bill needs to be amended so that it doesn't just ban the sale of flavored e-cigarettes, but it bans the sale of all tobacco products, including the ones that are actually killing people.
Well, I understand where you're coming from, but in the real world of America and our use and sale of tobacco products, do you imagine a city of Philadelphia banning tobacco products?
Absolutely. I mean, I think this is 2019. The tobacco companies no longer have the political power that they used to. And, you know, I don't think that there's any public health justification for saying that, you know, we're willing to take on the vaping industry because they're not that powerful, but we're not really willing to stand up for the health of our kids when it comes to the tobacco industry.
I mean, kids should not be smoking. They should not be vaping or smoking. And by law, Michael, they're prevented from doing that.
Right, right. And that's true for pretty much any tobacco product.
Well, I do want to – I understand what you're saying about tobacco, and that does, I think, complicate any kind of conversation that we have, Sean, about vaping. And, you know, when you're comparing the deaths, the illnesses, there is really no comparison, at least as we understand it now.
In terms of the health effects?
In terms of the health effects.
Well, probably not in the sheer number of deaths that we've experienced from tobacco, but then again, we don't know. Like Dr. Farley said, these products are new, and we don't have any cases where people have used a product for more than 10 years. So as those cases continue to build up, we will watch the health risk profile of these things, you know, clarify. The individual health effects are going to be different from the population level effects, and so we have to continue to work mm-hmm. to tease those apart.
Do you think that these products were rushed too quickly to the market before we really knew what was in them and what they did?
Probably, yeah. The smarter move, right, would be to say that let's make sure that these things aren't really, really causing some serious long-term damage. And it looks like some of the young people have very serious, severe, irreversible lung damage, where their lungs look like COPD patients that are 70 years old, and it's a 17-year-old, and they're going to have to live with that reduced lung capacity for the rest of their life. It will never come back.
Is that this popcorn lung that we've been hearing about?
Yeah, I think the more medical term is bronchiolitis obliterans.
And that's from using not THC, but regular sort of the kind of so-called legal products that you can use inside of a vape device?
With all the hospitalizations, there is many cases of that sort of irreversible lung damage, and then there's lots of fluid buildup and that sort of thing. And how that all breaks down in terms of the THC only versus nicotine only, I'm not quite sure, but it's serious damage no matter what product. And yes, it's the majority of these serious health issues are caused by THC products, but there is 10 to 15% that report only using a nicotine product.
Michael, can you weigh in? You've actually written about this, the vaping-associated respiratory illness. What do you know, or what do we know at this point?
Well, I think that what's clear is that the predominant, the overwhelming majority of these cases are associated with the vaping, not of electronic cigarettes, but of THC, especially products that are being obtained off the black market, which are contaminated with a very viscous oil that probably has chemicals in it, like such as pesticides and other toxic chemicals, and that seems to be what's causing the injury. So far, there's no solid evidence that nicotine-containing e-cigarettes that are purchased at stores, at retail stores, have any role in this outbreak. In fact, the chances that those products are involved are minuscule because these products have been on the market for several years. And there hasn't been any problem. This is clearly something new that's affecting the market. And these products, you know, it's extremely unlikely that they're involved. Overall, 90% of the patients have admitted to using THC, but we know that youth in particular are very reluctant to admit that they're using THC. It's illegal. There can be consequences for them in school. For extracurricular activities, sports activities. And so we know that there's a lot of underreporting. So I think it's actually remarkable that despite the underreporting that we know is going on, that 90% of these cases are admitting to THC use. So I think that what's going on here is a problem with the black market. It's not a problem with e-cigarettes that are being purchased over from stores. And I think it's dangerous to conflate the two.
You want to respond to that, Sean?
Well, first, I would say let's not forget that, having a youth addicted to nicotine is not really a great outcome we want anyway. So let's do everything we can to avoid that.
Yes.
I guess I would like to think that it would be safe to say that we can let the products that come from a store that are produced by a large manufacturer, non-black market products, it'd be nice if we could let them off the hook. But unfortunately, I would look at things just a little bit more complicated than that, namely through the social norming effect that, you know, maybe the extent to which these things are seen as normal, safe, popular, they're available. That's a product of both black market and non-black market sales and outlets and that sort of thing. So even though those products may not, even though store-bought products may be, quote, safer than a black market product that has pesticides and all these different cheap oils in it and that sort of thing, if it continues to perpetuate the norm that people vape, people inhale things, people use these devices, that trickles into our culture and the youth priorities and their interests and that sort of thing, and then they're potentially more likely to pick up other products. So I don't think
do
we can just let
gateway?
Them off the
Is
hook.
It a, do you, should we think of it as a gateway drug?
Well, if you look at where they're getting them and what they're using, youth are finding these products at retail outlets, online, and from social sources. And then if they're picking up products because of the fruity flavors, if you want to use that as your definition of a gateway product, it would I think that would be pretty fair to say.
Michael, let me go back to you. And you mentioned nicotine, and vaping products have nicotine in them. Is that a danger just in and of itself?
Well, I think the problem is not so much that they have nicotine in them, but the fact that many of these products have extremely high levels of nicotine, and specifically in a form of a nicotine salt. nicotine salts, unlike freebase nicotine that most e-cigarettes have, are absorbed incredibly rapidly into the bloodstream. And a product like Juul uses nicotine salts. There are a couple of brands that are kind of copycats of Juul that have come out that use nicotine salts as well. That's something that I think the FDA should be controlling. I don't think there's any reason why we should have a product on the market that has 54 milligrams per milliliter of nicotine. In the UK, they have a limit of 20, and these products are working really well. Lots of smokers are able to quit using the product, so I don't see why we need levels that are more than twice as high in the U.S. when the lower levels are working fine in the U.K. So I do think that the nicotine levels need to be regulated.
I was asking the health commissioner about children, teenagers smoking in school, and he said, you know, it is happening. Sean, you were telling me about some of the things that young people can wear or do that essentially hides the fact that they are vaping. And I would love to have you explain how that works.
Yeah, I'm sure people have heard some stories, but yeah, as we heard from Dr. Frawley, the plume it dissipates quickly, so it's easy to hide. You can blow it into your sleeve or into your shirt. There's a product that we mentioned earlier that includes a hoodie sweater, and the drawstring on the hoodie actually has the vape device in it, so you could look like you're sort of just sucking on the string of your hoodie, but you're actually vaping nicotine or THC. We've had reports of there being social media games where someone will take a puff or a drag from a Juul or some other device, leave it somewhere in a hallway, and take a picture using Snapchat or some other social media thing at platform, and then the first person to run and find it and take the next hit and put it somewhere else, and then they take another picture. So it's causing all sorts of problems in schools. I have a friend who's a superintendent, and the staff don't know what to do. They don't know what's in the products. The school nurse doesn't quite know. So we're spending a lot of time helping schools decide how they want to deal with this, implement policies, making sure that we provide opportunities to train their staff to do in-services for health and PE teachers, anybody who wants it, and let them know that there are all sorts of programs and policies that schools can use to prevent and treat. Now we have to actually treat youth that are addicted. So that's a whole new world that we're forced to enter in terms of public health.
And we're talking about vaping with Sean McCormick and Michael Siegel. And with you, 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. You can also tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Michael Siegel, let me go back to you. Has vaping been helpful? It hasn't been approved as a smoking cessation tool. Nonetheless, have smokers gone to vaping and essentially given up their habit?
Absolutely. There's no question that vaping has been a lifesaver for literally millions of Americans who were formerly highly dependent on cigarettes, addicted to cigarettes, and who were able to quit completely by switching to e-cigarettes. In fact, there are 2.5 million of them, 2.5 million ex-smokers in the U.S. who have quit successfully and completely by switching to e-cigarettes. And I think this is why the proposals to completely ban the sale of flavored e-liquids make no sense and would actually cause devastating public health impacts. I think what Philadelphia is proposing does make sense because it's not banning the sale of these products. They're just being restricted to certain stores. But smokers or ex-smokers can still access them. But we have to recognize that at the national level, there's legislation that would actually ban the sale of flavored e-liquids at any store. And many states have passed emergency legislation to ban the sale of flavored e-liquids, or in Massachusetts, all e-liquids. And so those proposals or laws are really devastating because they're literally going to force hundreds of thousands of people who successfully quit smoking to either go back to smoking, which would be a disaster for them, or to turn to black market products, which is also a disaster for the reasons that we're seeing now with this outbreak.
And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I mean, it is a tricky thing about, and I'm looking at you, Sean McCormick, about, you know, how do you regulate something that does have some risk for people that are using it? I mean, I think tobacco is an example of, in a sense, and you're looking at an ex-smoker here, of what not to do. I mean, just the availability the availability of tobacco products are just, it's just, you know, having huge health consequences. How do we find that middle ground? Or do we? Is there one?
Well, that's a great question. I think more research, high-quality research, long-term studies, and in different settings, different populations with different age groups, different cultures, different parts of the world, different parts of the United States. There's a lot we don't know. Lots of people may switch to vaping or e-cigarettes and then come back. I heard Dr. Siegel say completely quit, but what we know from most nicotine and tobacco users is that it's more like, is your dependence level controlled or not? And people usually go through times where they're doing pretty well and other times that they're not. Maybe there are some folks that completely quit, and that's great, but right. A lot of times it's kind of a back and forth thing. And so with the 7 FDA-approved products, that are completely safe, why wouldn't we just always lean on those as a first, second, third?
A patch, something like that?
Patch, gum, lozenge, combinations. They took the black box warning off of varenicline, Chantix. There was some adverse psychiatric effects being reported, but the incidence rates of those have been found to be so low that they actually took the black box warning off. Those medications are great because you can start them before you go to quit smoking, and you combine that with the nicotine replacement products, and people have pretty high success rates.
I'd like to have you respond to that, Michael Siegel, about just and we have about a minute before our first break here, or our second break here, I should say, but just a quick response, and then we'll pick up after the break.
Yeah, so I think nicotine replacement products and drugs like Chantix are fantastic for the 10% of people who are successful using these products. But the data shows us that 90% of people who try those methods are not successful. And as a public health professional, I'm not going to throw those 90% of people under the bus by saying, well, that didn't work for you, but we're not going to give you any choice. I mean, we do have this alternative that 2.5 million people have used successfully. And I think it's imperative on us as public health professionals to make that available to the 90% of people who aren't going to quit using nicotine replacement therapy.
I've got to jump in here, and we have to take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation talking about some of the pros and cons of vaping. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at pennmedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We're talking about some of the pros and cons of vaping, the impact of regulations and advertising, how public health officials view vaping, how it compares to smoking. And our guests are Sean McCormick. He's Assistant Director of Tobacco Control and Prevention Services at the Health Promotion Council here in Philadelphia. Michael Siegel joining us from the Boston area. He's a physician professor of community health and sciences at Boston University. And you can join our conversation. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY. Radio Times. Michael, you were saying that something like 2.5 million people have used vaping as a way to give up smoking. Do we know whether they gave it up for good or did they go back? Have we been able to follow them and just find out whether they were able to completely quit these products?
Yeah, well, the 2.5 million are the people who've completely quit and they're not going back. They may go back, however, if we ban those products, if we ban the flavored e-cigarettes that they're currently relying on. And so, no, they're not going to go back to smoking. They are now vaping. They're vapers, and they have a very strong identity as vapers. The danger is if we take that away from them, then there is a great risk that they might go back to smoking, and that's what I'm concerned about.
Are you concerned? I mean, can someone be a lifelong vapor and be healthy?
Well, absolutely. I mean, certainly much healthier than they would be if they were a lifelong smoker. There's no question about that. You know, in an ideal world, would anyone be vaping? No. But we don't live in an ideal world. And in public health, we don't try to, reach an ideal situation. We try to protect the health of the public. And we know that there are at least 35 million smokers still out there, mm-hmm. and I think what we need to try to do is give them every opportunity to every option that's available to quit smoking. There's no question that that's the number one thing we can do to protect the public's health. That is the number one cause of preventable disease. So I think that the advent of vaping has been a tremendous opportunity for adult smokers in that, you know, again, 90% of them aren't going to succeed with nicotine replacement therapy. So this gives those, you know, that 90% an option that is working for many of them. Why would we want to take that away?
Well, and at this point, we're not, no one's banning vaping products yet, but I realize that it's part of the discussion. But Sean, how do you feel about someone who would be a lifelong vapor versus a lifelong smoker?
Yeah, we don't know yet, right? We've talked about this. We're just not quite sure. It's tough to say overall if these things will be healthier. It's looking like the health risk profile is different. I'll say that. Mm-hmm. Beyond that, you know, there's a little bit of number games going on. People make multiple quit attempts. People may try cold turkey. They may try a patch. They may try cold turkey again. They may then try vaping. They may then go back to regular cigarettes. We just don't know. Every single person is different. There are probably some folks, and I appreciate Dr. Siegel's, you know, there are some folks that take on the persona like, this is what I do now, and this potentially saved my life. We can't discount some benefit from some of that. Hopefully, right? If the differences in the health risk are substantial and these products are that much safer, well, then I would go along with Dr. Farley and say, let's do the studies, let's do the tests and show that it is safe to vape for a long time and that people don't go back. And those are questions we still have up in the air.
Right. And I would think, Michael Siegel, as a public health official yourself, that, I mean, more data is always good to have so we know what we're dealing with here.
Absolutely. I mean, there's no question that we need to do more research. But I think we know enough at the present time to be extremely confident that vaping is safer than smoking and to be confident that electronic cigarettes are more effective than the nicotine patch in helping smokers quit. I mean, we have a clinical trial published earlier this year in the New England Journal of Medicine. People were randomized to either get the nicotine patch or e-cigarettes, and the e-cigarette group actually quit at twice the frequency of the nicotine patch group. These clinical trials are pretty definitive, and so it's the best type of research that we have available. So, I mean, yeah, could we use more research? Certainly. We can mm-hmm. always use more research. And as a researcher, I'm always happy to take money to do research. But the reality is we know enough to draw two important conclusions. Number one, it's safer than smoking. And number two, it is more effective in helping people quit than anything else we have available.
Because obviously with the patch, I'm looking at you, Sean. I mean, with the patch, there is no device, you know, that thing that you put in your mouth. With the patch is you're not smoking and you're not vaping.
Right.
Which is maybe harder than both.
Yeah, it's tricky. I think one of the bigger revelations is actually not that big of a deal, but most folks, I think, had a preconceived notion that you couldn't use, like, the nicotine patch and the nicotine gum at the same time. But that's actually not true. That opens up the door for people to put together their own strategy. Wake up first thing, put the patch on. That's helping with low-level nicotine withdrawal. And then in moments of mini crises, very strong urge, using a piece of nicotine gum or nicotine lozenge, completely safe and ups the chances of staying abstinent by whatever percent. Mm. But those products are safe. So,
here's a comment from Ruthie. She says, everyone keeps talking about THC as if it were evil, but it's in a lot of other marijuana products. I'm worried that people are sensationalizing these products in an irresponsible way. What if the facts that we know apart from anecdotal evidence? And I think, Michael, you have looked at that in some of your research about the role of THC in some of these vape devices and how that has led to some problems.
Yeah, so maybe I should make it very, very clear that it's not the THC itself that's causing these illnesses. It's the agent that is used to cut the THC, in other words, to dilute the THC. So it's the additives that are being added to create a vaping liquid for the THC. It's not the THC itself. And it's also mostly black market products. So, you know, this is not to say that there's something, you know, that THC shouldn't be used for people who are, you know, either using it recreationally or certainly for medical use. But what it is to say is that when you have a product that is basically regulated or is not regulated, it's just illegal, you end up getting a black market developing. Mm-hmm. And that's where the dangers arise, because that product, which in and of itself isn't harmful, is now being made in a way that it gets contaminated. And so what this argues for is having a regulated market for products that people are using rather than a black market where you really have no control over what's in the product. And that's the problem we're facing now. I mean, the reason why we're not able to kind of stop this outbreak is because these products are unregulated. We can't ban them. They're banned. They're already banned. And that's why we can't just, you know, wave a magic wand and end this outbreak. If these products were all regulated and if there were not a black market, we would be able to just shut this down immediately and stop the outbreak. And so this is why we have to be careful and not ban e-cigarettes like some states are either thinking about or, in the case of Massachusetts, have done, because what's going to happen is it's going to just put these products all onto the black market, and then we're going to see more outbreaks like the one we're seeing today, because we're not going to know what's in the products, and somebody's going to end up trying to make money by using, you know, cutting corners, and some contaminant's going to get in there that's dangerous.
Sean, we've been talking about how vaping is a way of quitting smoking. Is there any evidence that vaping leads to smoking? That, for instance, a young person starts to vape at the age of 15, 16, 17, 18, and then becomes a smoker?
Yes. Yes, there's been a few studies now that show that there is a significantly increased likelihood that a young person would start with vaping, and if they do so, then they are more likely to end up smoking traditional combustible tobacco.
Rather than the young person who doesn't do any of it, I mean, doesn't start vaping at all.
Correct.
Is that something just about the product itself or the sort of mentality of that particular person? Do we know?
We're not sure. That's sort of one of those chicken egg things. Some people are sensation seekers. Some people are risk takers and they're rebelling, and that's just they're going to rebel, and it's either electronic or combustible, or it doesn't matter. They're just rebelling. They want to try something new. They want to take a risk. But there's also the nicotine component, which makes these products addictive, and nicotine is in both these products. And it hasn't come up yet, but one of the largest tobacco companies is now the majority shareholder of Juul, and Juul's original CEO stepped down and Juul's now headed up by a tobacco CEO. So these are the same companies, and they need replacement smokers. So no doubt some are switching, and they're probably pretty happy about that.
Michael Siegel, when I was talking with the health commissioner, he talked about this plan in Philadelphia to try to reach out to young people through social media. And one of the messages is that you're dealing with a big company. They don't care about you. They just want your money. Do you think that's an effective message, public health message, for a young person?
Well, absolutely. I mean, that's the message that worked in getting kids not to smoke. I mean, it wasn't telling them about the health effects of smoking. You know, they didn't really care about what happens 40 years down the road. But they do care about being taken advantage of. And so the message that the tobacco industry is manipulating them and essentially trying to addict them, that message does resonate with youth. So, yeah, absolutely. I think that the idea of having a campaign that's focused on, you know, these products, especially the ones that contain the nicotine salts, that they're designed to addict people. Mm-hmm. Now, of course, their use for adults is one thing, but I think from the perspective of youth, having them understand the differences between these products and understanding that these nicotine salt products are specifically designed for addiction, I think is an effective way of having kids think twice about what e-cigarettes are all about.
And how significant is it that tobacco companies are now owning, you know, buying up some of these vaping companies?
I think it's very significant because the economic incentive for an independent e-cigarette company by independent, I mean not owned by tobacco, is completely to get people to quit smoking. There's absolutely no incentive for them to have anybody smoking a single cigarette. The more people that quit and the more quit completely, the more money they make. But with a tobacco company, it's different because they're going to make money if people smoke and they're going to make money if people vape. So that strong incentive to get everybody to quit is just not there. And so this is another problem with banning the flavored e-cigarettes, because what's going to happen is that the only companies that are going to be left on the market are the big tobacco companies, because the way the FDA is regulating these products now, in order to stay on the market, you have to submit an application to the FDA, and these are expensive applications. They cost millions of dollars, and so the only companies that really are going to survive are the tobacco companies, and that's not what we want. We want a very large and diverse market with really more independent companies than tobacco companies, and we're going to have exactly the opposite.
And you're listening to Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. Here's an email from Marie. Is there any data on the effects of secondhand consumption of vape products? I'm looking at you, Sean. Is there an impact there at all?
I believe there have been some studies on that. And in comparison to secondhand smoke, I'm pretty sure that the health effects are fairly limited. But I think there are trace amounts of heavy metals, a little bit of nicotine, and the vegetable glycerin and propylene glycol that help make the plume or the aerosol vape cloud. That you can experience some exposure to those things, but I don't think there's the same amount of direct inflammation that's very easily measurable.
And what about advertising? Should there be sort of stricter rules about how these products are advertised?
We're in a tough spot with advertising. They're getting free advertisement at this point with sponsors and Instagram models and social media influencers. Some of those folks, they're not being paid. They just, here's the new pod from this company. Here's a new flavor, and I'm at this beautiful vacation spot filming myself trying it out, and it's going to get views, and they're going to increase their own career by getting those views. And it happens to be that they weren't being paid to sponsor that product. So
right. We could and do they have all... their right to say these things, right?
They do.
Let me get from you, Michael, and about a minute or so before we have to say goodbye, but do you think there should be stricter controls over how these products are advertised?
Absolutely. I mean, I think that all of the rules that we have with tobacco should apply to e-cigarettes. With tobacco, you're not allowed to target youth in your advertising. And I think those same rules should apply for e-cigarettes. Sean is absolutely right. You know, you can't control what some youth puts on, you know, their Instagram or social media. You can't control that. But there are certain things we can control, and we can certainly control the places where companies are allowed to advertise, making sure that they can't advertise on media that have a lot of youth audience. And we can also regulate the type of ads and making sure they're not using youth-friendly themes.
Well, we're going to leave it there. Michael Siegel, thank you so much for joining us once again on Radio Times to talk about vaping.
Thanks again for having me. I appreciate it.
No problem. And he's a physician, also professor of community health and sciences at Boston University. Sean McCormick, thank you for joining us once again to talk about vaping.
Of course.
With our guests. And he's assistant director of tobacco control and prevention services at the Health Promotion Council here in Philadelphia. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times, and you can find out more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show. You can find us on Facebook. You can also follow us on Twitter. Adam Staniszewski, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Debbie Builder, John Ahrens, and Kelsey Hansen. I'm Marty Moscow. Thank you so much for joining us.